Welcome to the Property Couch, where each week you get to listen to two of Australia's leading property experts as they share with you the insider's guide to property investing.
Well, hello folks, Bryce Holdaway, Ben Kingsley, you're on the Property Couch, your insider's guide to property investing. And Ben, big news overnight.
Huge news, Bryce.
Australia went through to the World Cup final. Now, you being cricket. A red-blooded male
right.
who grew up in Australia,
yeah.
a country boy, how did you miss the cricket journey?
Yeah, well, easy. It's the croquet of the 17th century. So, yes, you'll get from me that. Mind you, I probably watched 15 minutes of it.
You did?
So, yeah, I came home from a basketball game and had to cool down a bit. So I just thought I'll check the score because it was the semi-final of the World Cup. So I'm abreast of it. Don't ask me the name of the players in the team other than probably, you know, two or three that I can name.
Well, I was going to say, you hopefully would have seen the pivotal moment when Maxwell threw down the stumps from side on to get MS Dhoni out, which probably sent Australia into the World Cup final. But we're here to talk about property today.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about asset selection. And we've put this in on purpose. We've done this third because in our property investment formula, it's A, B, C, D, asset selection, borrowing power, cash flow management, and defence. But we've purposely put asset selection third because we think that most people start with asset selection, but we think that property investment is a process and not an event. And so it's important we're going to chat about today. But we've got so much to talk about here, Ben. And I guess for us to try and keep this in sort of 15 to 20 minutes, I think today we should talk about a couple of things. New versus old.
Yep.
Apartment versus house.
Yep.
And who you should take your advice from, whether it's free or whether it's fee. So which one do you want to kick off on?
Well, typically I'll always start with the big picture stuff, which is trying to understand the concept of asset selection and what it is that drives value, and then we can sort of get into the nitty-gritty. So for me, it's an understanding of a few things. Firstly, and most importantly, we've got to understand economics. So we've got to understand how the economy is running in a particular marketplace and how diversified is the economy. So there's the macro mm-hmm. in terms of what it looks like. So if you've got a large city with a diversified economy, London, New York, Boston, coming around through Asia, Tokyo, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So once you've understood the size of these cities and the scarcity value around the land that's associated with that, we then need to understand the human interest and human behavior stuff. So this is probably one of my biggest message. Mm. And that is around, everyone keeps talking about how can property prices keep going higher. Well, it's pretty clear how they can because property is an emotional asset.
It is.
And being an emotional asset, it basically means that people will pay a premium for the asset if they can afford to pay the premium. So when I study property in terms of for growth, so we're focused in on the growth story here, I'm studying human interest and human behavior because what I'm looking for is the elements that drive people to a location. Because once I know that, and if there's, you know, if the location has a status like Mossman or Point Piper or Toorak or Middle Park or those types of things, if people drop those names, people go, you must be successful or you must be doing well because you're living in an elite area. And then you overlay that with, well, actually, what is it about the area that people want? And it usually comes down to the type of accommodation they're looking for, but it's also conveniences, congestion, getting to quick to their primary place of residence and the lifestyle drivers, the coffee shops, the Thai restaurants, the you know, those types of things are what people are looking for. So you put that combination together and you get demand from owner-occupiers. And when you get those owner-occupiers who want to buy and they want to get in, they'll pay a premium. So our job as investors, if we're chasing growth, is to get behind that and get on that story.
So what I'm hearing you say there, Ben, is you haven't even talked about bricks and mortar yet. So do you think that that's a conversation well down the track?
Well, let me give a bit of gold to our listeners. 80% of your return is going to come from the property that you buy and 20%, sorry, from the location that you buy. And only 20%.
Oh, rewind, start that
rewind.
Again.
So 80% from the location, 20% from the property. Now that's a default position, okay? So if you pick the right area, but still pick an asset that isn't necessarily the right asset, you'll still get the uplift. Now the only disclaimer to that, or the only exception to that rule, is medium and high density accommodation. So medium and high density accommodation, because there is zoning for that, you have no scarcity value. Mm. So if there's more high rises that can go into that great location, then technically you're going to have an underperforming asset. So, and let me just explain that. I'll unpack it quickly for our listeners. What I'm talking about there is when you get a location right, you actually get the status right, the lifestyle drivers and so forth, and the assets can be improved. But when you actually can tweak that a little bit, and by tweaking it, I mean, in some cases, there's intrinsic value in the actual property you buy. So this is where it moves from an 80-20 principle to maybe as low as a 60-40 principle, whereas the area is giving you 60% of your uplift. But when you get that character asset, that charming home, that perfectly laid out livability in terms of the internals of the house, then people get emotionally attached to the actual physical asset. No different than a beautiful convertible, you know, or some type of classic car. That's exactly what's happening. So for me, you'll then see an outperform on the actual asset. But again, it's still underpinned by the area in which that asset is. And I'll further support that with one final point. Here I am, mate. You can't stop me on this stuff.
No, mate. It's, we love hearing you. Come on.
What? Let's say we've got a beautiful character home or a mansion of a stately period that's in, you know, Castlemaine's a good example because, you know, Castlemaine was a very rich area when the gold rush occurred and there were magnificent houses built out there, mansions built out in Castlemaine, the same time they were building them in Hawthorne, Toorak, Camberwell. Now, so if we look at those types of things, Castlemaine about an hour and 20 minutes from Melbourne, we saw at the same period of time, there was probably the same value in them. Now, handcrafted, you know, fretwork, amazing, and those types of things. Fast forward to today, and because of its location, you can pick up that mansion and you can drop that mansion into Hawthorne, Camberwell, Toorak, wherever you may be, and you're talking maybe 5 to 7 million, if not more. You pick that same asset up and you put it, or you keep that same asset in Castlemaine, and you're probably talking about a mil two. So from that point of view, isn't that a perfect story? Mm. Exactly the same physical asset in the wrong location. And that's what we talk about, the science of asset selection and location.
So what I'm hearing there is average property in a good location is better than a good property in an average location. You've actually done that recently where you helped a client buy in one of Brisbane's elite suburbs, where at face value, if you look at the photos of the property, you probably wouldn't pull it out at the barbecue and impress
your
mates.
Oh, she was an ugly duckling. Was a, you know, she was an ugly duckling, reliable and durable, two better, surrounded by houses in the vicinity of entry level 1.2.
Amazing houses.
To, you know, to almost $3 million. And here's this little ugly duckling block of four, and we've just picked it up for under $300,000, you know, sort of in November last year. That's the type of thing where I can say, look, I'm in a beautiful area, great status, great appeal. Anyone tells you you live in that suburb, they're like, ooh, you know, Ascot or whatever it may be. So from that point of view, that's exactly the type of thing that a skilled technician can find and implement, as opposed to someone who's just going, well, I need to buy that fancy new asset and I get, you know, mixed up with that, which is a good segue into new versus old, isn't it, Bryce?
Well, I think so, because I think the point here too is telescope versus microscope. And at no stage had you started any of that conversation with talking about, you know, taps and floor plans. You'd started with getting the bigger picture right. And I think that's the big message here today for the listeners, is that most people actually start with the property and work backwards. So we talk about the example of someone at a barbecue talking about the Great Australian Barbecue topic, saying, hey, did you know that 22 Smith Street's up for sale? And the mate goes, no, I didn't know 22 Smith Street. Mate, you should buy it as an investment. And effectively, it starts at the property and then works backwards, where you've put a very strong case together to say, hey, two things. One, location does 80% of the heavy lifting, and then you can get the cream from getting the property selection right. So in this case, starting with area, starting even in, if you think of Australia as, it's not one big market, it's made of hundreds and hundreds of submarkets. You've got to start with state and then get down to suburb and then down to street before we even start talking about the property. So I think that's an important message. But I started my career, I bought my first investment property, which was a brand new property, and subsequent purchases since then have been established. And I think that's probably a typical tale that you would hear from an average investor in this country, because they get sold on the
The bling,
or should we call it size versus shine?
Oh, look, they get sold on the marble bench tops and the stainless steel appliances and the so-called depreciation attached to that. But what's happening is that you're buying the developer's profit line. So, you know, you're getting sold on the established benchmark pricing in the area. So where's your uplift, crew? Mm. You know, you've got to be sensible about this, and sensible in terms of there is a science, and it's about getting an outperform result. So it's crazy to think that you wouldn't do that. Again, let's get into the headspace, Bryce, of the buyer. We call it the buyer's quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get into the headspace. The first thing people do, as you mentioned before, is they look at the property in a location. Now, when they look at a property in the location, that's because we're trained to, because all the search engines tell us, well, before we can even start looking for a property, we basically need to go into the search engines and put a suburb in before we can even start looking. So then we think, well, we'll get the prettiest house in that suburb. No real science done to that. Mm-hmm. The other part of the buyer's quadrant, and I don't want to steal this because this is a session for another podcast, I'm sure,
yeah.
But we're basically talking about what we can afford. Now, last week we talked about borrowing power, and borrowing power was exactly that message, which was you send 5,000 people to a location, if they can only get minimum wage, where's the uplift in value? Mm. You know, you're just not going to get it. Then the other thing we then have to solve, the problem of getting into the buyer's headspace, is picking the type of property. What are we going to get for our bang for buck? You know, size versus quality, all those types of things.
Or size versus bling, as you call it.
Absolutely. And finally, we're then getting into, you know, what is the actual quality of that asset? So what's happening there? But we'll unpack the buyer's quadrant in terms of getting into the headspace in another podcast.
Yeah, we will go into that in depth. But one of the things you just mentioned is depreciation. Now, for the listeners, if you're a first-time property investor, or if you're thinking about buying an investment property for the first time, please, please, please don't be seduced by the allure of depreciation. It's quite often the number one thing that a salesperson will go into, and they'll try and convince you that it's all about tax and it's all about depreciation, but it's not. It's all about the growth. So we've got a very strong bias, haven't we, Ben, towards established property over new. And again, we'll probably go into that in more depth in another podcast. But ultimately, the depreciation argument can be counteracted very, very quickly. If I'm buying a property that I think would be compromised in its investment grade appeal, its scarcity, and its owner occupier appeal just to get depreciation, instead of buying maybe an established property that's built pre-1985, which, you know, those selling depreciation or T is no good because you can't get any depreciation on the building, and because the internals are a bit more tired, you know, it doesn't have the same depreciation. Here's the key. You'd be buying in a better growth location, so the capital growth will be improved, and you can create depreciation instead of buying it. And what I mean by that is at some point in the future, you can go through and do a strategic renovation on the property and create your own depreciation. And there's many, many depreciation benefits that can come from that. So listeners, don't be seduced by the allure of depreciation.
And if I can add to that, two other points. The other point is new becomes old. So if you're seeing in the suburb, two-bedroom accommodation being flogged for $550,000, all the new with the bling, and around the corner there's the same floor space with basically a tired apartment block, but still in good condition, so reliable and durable. But you know, you're going to see that you can buy that for $100,000 cheaper than the new bling. So in 20 years' time, are they both old? I mean, you know, so the reality is that older property is potentially going to get a better yield, and it's also going to get the uplift in terms of the price growth that's going to occur. So it's going to be an outperforming asset. The second point I wanted to make there is when people are trying to promote new, they're trying to promote it based on holding costs. So how they attack the household in terms of try to convince you that it's a good buy is they attack you or pressure you into the idea, this is only going to cost $50 a week for you to hold once we factor in all this depreciation.
Mm.
Now, that sounds good, obviously, if the purse strings can't afford it. But the reality is you can, you know, for an extra $20, $30, $40 a week, you can actually hold the existing property, which is going to give you some capital growth as well as a higher rental yield. So it's just crazy to think that you would just focus on that. Now, we have bought new. Don't be mistaken. If the new asset stacks up, we'll buy it. But it's very, very rare. You know, we buy, 150 to almost 200 properties a year now, Bryce, for our clients. So the question for, and in that, there might be, one, two new ones? Yeah,
particularly for occupiers.
So we're looking for, if we are looking for new, we're looking for boutique, small, you know, maybe one of three, one of four on their own titles, if they've been subdivided into townhouses and so forth. So we'll buy them, but they've got to stack up in terms of their price point. The last thing I want to be doing is buying a property, if I work out the median house price on two-bedroom apartments in that suburb, and this is 30% higher because it's brand new. Well, there's no growth in that. You know, I don't want to be the champion of pushing prices higher. I'd much prefer to grab something around the median value and get dragged up.
No, I agree. Look, often you get the argument too about land is what drives the price the value of property, the amount of land content that you have. So it's kind of segue into our apartment versus house. My dad's born in 1939. He's pre-baby boomer. My mum's born in 1948. I'm born 1975, my wife's 1980. So across the dinner table, there's four generation types. And it's interesting to have a conversation about property because my dad's view of the great Australian dream is that detached house on a quarter acre block surrounded by a garden with a Hills hoist and a barbecue versus Gen Y. My wife acts more like a Gen X than a Y, but typically a Gen Y, they've grown up seeing different things as the norm. The sitcoms that they've watched are, you know, Friends and How I Met Your Mother, they're all apartment living style programs, whereas we grew up watching Neighbours and Home and Away. And hey, what is it?
What, the one, the physicist, what's that one? It's on,
I don't know. What's the not on Gen X? I don't know these Gen Y programs.
No, it's on all the time. The nerds, all the group of nerds who are physicists on the...
Oh, yeah, the Big Bang Theory.
The Big Bang Theory, there you go. Another example, they're all in an apartment block, you know, living next door to each other.
I think that's a good point, Ben, because here we are, we're both Gen X, and we're sort of struggling to think of what that is. But in 2020, for the first time in living memory, the baby boomers won't be the dominant household type in the workforce. So Gen Y and Gen X will largely be dominating the space. So what's worked in the 20th century might not necessarily work in the 21st century. So here's the message. It's not about land content. It's about land value. So let's use an example. If I've got $500,000 to spend on investment property and I can buy a two-bedroom apartment 5Ks out from the CBD on one of, say, 12 apartments, and I can't actually walk outside and say, that bit of land is mine, but I can say 1/12 of this land is mine. I've got a beautiful Edwardian. I've got a beautiful Victorian as neighbours. I can walk two blocks away to get on the train. I can a couple of blocks away to get my favourite coffee on a Saturday morning versus someone who said, it's all about land. And then you have to look around and go, where can I buy land for my $500,000? You move 20Ks out to actually buy that. So really, they'd be quite comfortable saying, well, I've got the land. That's what's going to go up in value. But in our view, clearly, it's about a lifestyle driver on the underpinning of the land value. But another point that I want to make with that is this. If you're spending $500,000 on an apartment close to the CBD, a very large percentage of your $500,000 goes towards the land value, and a small percentage of it actually goes towards the building because the building's depreciating, it's usually pretty old. Versus the flip side, if you go further out into some of the new subdivisions, for example, a very large percentage of the purchase price actually goes towards the building, which depreciates, and a very small percentage goes towards the land. So that actually helps undo that argument about land content because it's all about land value.
It is, and we talk about land to asset ratio, and we definitely want the land, even though it's a smaller portion of it, to be the greater percentage. So a good rule of thumb is you want to see the land to asset ratio around 60 to 70%. That's a great indicator. If you're not seeing that in terms of your land ratio, then you'd probably walk away from it when you're talking about a house. And then from a unit and townhouse point of view, you're still probably looking to find at least 30 to 35% of land value in that. And it's no different. I mean, you go down downtown Tokyo and, you know, a square foot of land can be over $1 million because they know that they can build 70 stories high. Mm. So it's all relative. It's all relative, and you need to understand that. So going out to Greenfield Estates and thinking you're getting more bang for buck in terms of buying out there is just the wrong idea. You're not going to get the type of person who has the income growth that's going to push that area. And I don't care how many coffee shops they're trying to replicate, it's not the same. It's not original. Whereas you get out there and they're saying we're building these little town villages and all that type of thing, and it's full of, you know, franchisee type things. The people who want the groovy and the different, which is the status and the recognition stuff, and it's that human nature type thing that's going on, they want the independent coffee shop. They want something that's a little bit more, bit more of the vibe about what's going on there. So that's why you get the underperforming and people don't want to move out there.
You're going to be gentrifying in the closer suburbs rather than, you know, fresh virgin development.
Absolutely.
We've got a couple of minutes to go, so we'll quickly get through this, Ben. But as the chair of the Property Investment Professionals, you're quite passionate about this. But who should you be taking your advice from when you're buying an investment property? Because you've got two choices.
Oh, this is a big conversation. Do we want to do that now or do that at another podcast?
Well, let's just touch on it quickly in terms of is it – there is a, I guess, the free advice versus fee advice. Just touch on it sort of on the top level. Is there anything that you see, maybe in terms of complaints even from what you receive at the PIPA?
There's no doubt that the people who are offering a free service and getting paid by the developer or the lender, they have a limited choice for you in terms of they're selling off the plans, or they're selling something that they think is worthy of your attention. And I've got to be mindful, obviously, as chair of PIPA, we've got members who charge fee for service and members who take a commission. So what you've just got to understand is when you're actually looking at what the opportunity is, are they giving me choice? And you've got to decide whether, well, I don't care if they're not giving me choice. If that's the thing you want to go for, great. But I'd be doing some research on the actual development and what's happening associated with that as well. So for me, obviously, and what we do is we're independent. So, you know, we're independent property investment advisors. And by that, I mean we don't have relationships with builders, developers, real estate agents that just deliver a stock, and we just pick from that stock and get a commission or a kickback from them. But ultimately, that's what you've got to decide. And I think in financial services, we're seeing a move towards more of that fee for service as opposed to commission based. And that's probably not a bad thing for people to sort of see the transparency in the marketplace.
Well, as you say, from a PIPA perspective, you do have members who are actually on the fee and the free side and the fee side. But ultimately, it's about asking one simple question to an advisor. What is the best property for me? And the answer is, if they ask, I'm not sure, I need to know more about you, that's a good sign. If they say, this is the one for you, that's probably the overarching message here, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about writing a script before diagnosing the situation, as we talk about it, you know, when we use a medical analogy. So, yeah, you've got to basically understand that, are they selling me something, or are they advising me, is probably the message.
You're right, Ben. That topic can be a total podcast in itself, and it will be at some stage in the future. But what I also wanted to encourage the listeners, if you go to thepropertycouch.com.au and leave us a question that you would like us to answer in one of these podcasts, we're really looking forward to the opportunity to answer two or three or four questions in one of the future podcasts. Given the fact that we're running over 20 minutes now, chances are we'll probably only answer one, but maybe we'll sneak two or three in. So thanks again for listening today. If you can go to the iTunes store and give us a 5-star rating, that would be wonderful, so we can help spread this message.
Are we just on iTunes, or are we also on Android?
Good question. On both. Yeah,
fantastic. So we're whichever phone company or whichever
you could pick the Apple user here, can't you? You can. If you go to whatever service you're getting your podcast and leave us a 5-star rating, that would be wonderful, because again, we're trying to give out this information as the insider's guide to property investing. And we're happy to talk about every and any topic that we can in the upcoming weeks. And if you also go to the Facebook page, or you can follow us on Instagram or Twitter. So in the last 3 weeks, we've covered asset selection, we've covered borrowing power, we've covered cash flow management. Next week, we're going to talk about the D-Ben, which is the defense. So hopefully we have some good news by the time we chat next week about...
The croquet.
The cricket.
Oh, that's right.
Good luck to Australia on Sunday. And we'll see you next week, folks. Thank you.
Arrivederci.